Welcome to Another Opening, Another Show, a musical theatre podcast, recorded at the Gawler Civic Centre on Kaurna land in South Australia. I'd like to introduce my new co-host, Michael.
Hi Jane, it's Michael here, and hello listeners.
It's lovely to have you join us, Michael, and you'll be the co-host for the foreseeable future.
Thank you, Jane. I look forward to being part of Another Opening, Another Show podcast. And don't forget, we also have an email address now that people can send anything they want in to talk about on the podcast.
Absolutely. So there's always been the opportunity to comment on Spotify and the cast box, but we now have a dedicated email address. Get your pencils. aoas@mail.com. In full, aoas@mail.com.
We would love to hear from you anywhere around the world. It could be anything about musical theatre. It could be what you do on the stage. Do you have any superstitions or any tips? What's your favourite? What things do you love about musical theatre?
And what things can't you stand? Also, we might direct you to write particularly about the next door that will be opening at the end of the episode.
Exciting. And also, what are your embarrassing moments on stage?
Oh, I love those.
Do you have any funny moments from your theatre career?
Or even having been in the audience. I am reminded of one. Now, I don't know this person, and so we won't be asking them to come on the show. But at a world premiere of a new production, which happened in Adelaide, interestingly enough, it was when microphones on a body were in their infancy. And somebody came off stage and went to the toilet, and we all heard what happened in there and the flushing.
Oh no, that is not good. That is not good.
So if you've got a story like that to tell, it doesn't have to.
We would love to hear it. Yeah. Now, dear listener, because this is my debut podcast on Another Opening, Another Show, I've come here today dressed in a New York Knickerbockers shirt, or the New York Knicks.
For the theatre-loving audience member, the New York Knickerbockers are not a costume shop. They are a basketball team.
Yes, but they're not called the New York Knickerbockers. It's just shortened to Knicks.
Yes.
So for all our listeners in New York who are on Broadway, either on and off stage, we salute you. Don't forget to stay tuned to the end when our special guest will take a look behind the next door and reveal the next musical to be featured on Another Opening, Another Show.
Welcome to episode number 5. The Wizard of Oz.
Yay!
Often the gateway to a lot of people's musical theatre love.
Oh yes, especially mine when I was a child. It was always on Saturday afternoons or Sunday afternoons on the TV. Absolutely wonderful to watch.
I was glad when they aired it in the afternoons because they used to do it a particular time of year, every year, starting at 7:30, but with so many ads that it didn't finish till 11. And so I never actually saw the end for years.
But they would always advertise it in a way that would make it special for children to watch.
Oh, yes. And families would stop. They would see that advertising all week long and stop and make a family night of it. We've kind of lost that these days with all the streaming, etc.
And who doesn't love We're After See?
We have to be careful. Now, remember, everybody, I always manage to weave this into every episode. Copyright infringement.
Oh, yes.
The Gawler Broadcasting Association made a decision to not apply for a license for us to play the actual songs.
Really?
Yes, because it is exorbitant and it only relates at this stage to our podcast, which is only one of many at Gawler Broadcasting Association.
Wonderful podcasts on the Gawler Broadcasting Association website.
What we do each episode is we curate a playlist from the musical that we are discussing. So when you click on your link to this, there will also be a link to the Spotify playlist. So there'll be music from the original film. There'll be maybe somebody's interesting interpretation of Over the Rainbow. Some of these newly created stuff in 2011 by Lloyd Webber et al., which we'll talk about in a minute. So when you've listened to this, go back to that page, and it's also on the Gawler Broadcasting Association page, and click on the link for the Spotify playlist of the music.
You're listening to Another Opening, Another Show, a musical theatre podcast.
A brief history of The Wizard of Oz. The beloved classic The Wizard of Oz is based on the 1900s children's novel The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum. The first on-stage version of The Wizard of Oz was a musical comedy created by L. Frank Baum, Paul Titchens and A. Baldwin Sloan and premiered in Chicago in 1902. It officially opened on Broadway in January of 1903 and became the longest-running show of the decade with over 290 performances.
That's amazing.
In those days, it was.
In under a year, to have it written and then on Broadway,
that's a big turnaround. The way the country absolutely just embraced the stories in the first place to get to doing a musical of it only 3 years later.
I think it's because of the writing.
Yes. We then have almost 30-something years before anybody thinks, let's make it a movie. Well, obviously, we had to go from there were some black and white movies that were made of shorts, little snippets of some of the stories, because there's more than one book about The Wizard of Oz. And then we had a smattering of some silence, some early talkies in black and white of stories about The Wizard of Oz or Dorothy and her adventures with the animal characters, if you will. And it just bubbled along. Then we get the movie musical from 1939. Now, I actually have a book somewhere, 1939, the year of films. It was amazing what came out that year. Now, we are at the end of the Depression. America is not yet into World War II. And somehow, movies were so beloved. Obviously, it's for the escapism. But some of these movies that year were like The Women, fantastic. Look it up. Watch it. They used incredible budget. So we're at the end of the Depression. It's 1939, so we've entered the war, but America has not yet entered World War II. But it's not a very flush time for the general community in America. So this movie took a lot of risks. This musical went through many directors, many, many writers trying to create a movie musical from these books.
Do you think they were trying to get it right the first time?
Absolutely. I think that the driving forces behind it wanted it to be absolutely spot on. There was a desire to use Shirley Temple. Now, dear listener, if you're so young you have not experienced Shirley Temple, get on the video streamer and get as much Shirley Temple as you can. Now, a lot of her stuff was set in the Deep South around the Civil War time, so you're going to have issues with the presentation of people of colour. But you do need to see this child. She was amazing. From the age of 3, she was leading films. Her ability to sing, her pitching was so good sometimes it was almost unbearable. Her tap dancing, marvellous tap dancing side by side with people like Bojangles Robinson. So she did not belong to MGM.
Now, for those listeners who aren't familiar with Shirley Temple, who would you say is the Shirley Temple of today?
There is some of those kids who have broken through from, say, JoJo Siwa or someone like that, mm-hmm. where they were found in a group situation. Because we don't have that studio system that existed back then where Mrs. Temple just ferried her child around audition to audition to audition. So there might be kids like that on Broadway now, but they are not leading films of their own and certainly not between the ages of 3 and 10 being the lead 3 or 4 shows a year. So Shirley Temple, we could do a whole thing just about her. She's amazing. And she then, when she became an adult, went, acting, not really interested in that. I want to do something real. Ended up becoming a senator for many, many years in the United States government. So she's amazing. However, she belonged to 20th Century Fox. So you belonged to a studio. You were under contract for years and years. And every single move you made had to be approved by the studio.
So at the time, she signed a contract with 20th Century Fox. She couldn't go and work for MGM on a movie, say.
Exactly.
You were exclusive to MGM.
Yes.
And you're exclusive to 20th Century Fox.
Mm. They were trying to do a talent swap between MGM and 20th Century Fox, where MGM was going to lend Clark Gable and Gene Harlow in exchange for Shirley Temple. So the lovely Shirley Temple was not part of this movie. They had written most of the score, expecting it to be our 10-year-old child. Then somebody over at MGM said, well, we've got Judy Garland and she's not actually working on anything at the moment. And they went, oh, well, let's give her a listen. And of course, they were blown away. So the composers, Yip Harburg and Harold Arlen, just went, oh my goodness, what a voice. We need to do something for this voice.
Give her the golden ticket.
And invented. Shirley Temple actually said in years later that it was a much better decision for the show as a whole to have had Judy Garland. Now, poor Judy, though, she worked 10, 12-hour days, was 16, was forced with a thing that changed the way her face looked. They put something above her teeth to make her face look different. Was on slimming pills, which began her lifelong trouble with addictive medication, and they bound her chest down so that she did not look like a budding teenager. That just led to a whole lot of body issues for her life, and they're terrible. Now, we wouldn't stand for that today. It would not be happening. Certainly not the way that they worked children to the bone. Now, what might surprise you, surprised me, was in 1939, it was not a success.
Really?
It did not make nearly enough money. And in 1949, they reissued it to the cinemas. So when our post-war Americans were with money again and feeling hopeful, and that's when it became the movie that everybody loves, not actually in 1939. It won Academy Awards and was critically acclaimed. Now, the Academy Awards, of course, were Best Song and Herbert Stothart, or Stothart, not sure, he composed the instrumental underscore and won Best Original Score. So that was interesting.
Very interesting.
Mm. So in 1945, we see the first stage musical that is taken from the film. And that was done at the Mooney, which is the St. Louis Municipal Opera, which, as you will begin to hear across many of these podcasts, a leading light in the Midwest of America for producing new works or really great revivals of older works. And then nothing on stage until 1987, when the Royal Shakespeare Company asked John Cain to write an adaptation of the film. And that much more closely followed the movie script than that 1945 version.
Why do you think there was such a long time between performances?
I think it's all to do with the technical side. Because you have to recreate a tornado, you have to have people flying. Now, people flew up into the rafters for many generations, but I really think it's because everyone wants the whiz bang. It's emblazoned in everyone's mind, all the colour, the lights, there'll be smoke, there'll be all these things, and it's very technically difficult to produce. I'm sure we've all seen school and community groups in our time doing their level best. But if you're at the Royal Shakespeare Company, you want to see as close as possible to the original that you can. And I think that is what took the time.
I think there was a little bit of hesitance from MGM.
It might have been worked on and worked on for years, and MGM has kept saying no, because they also want to protect the amazing film that they have, and they don't want not superior product. This 1987 production also brought in two numbers that were cut from the film. There's The Jitterbug, which is when they're on the Yellow Brick Road, and is often a favourite of children in community groups because they get to dress up like little ladybirds and do their little jitterbug. And a reprise of Over the Rainbow that's near the end when she has come back to Kansas. That was cut. The last 20 minutes of the film has no further singing. So once she has said goodbye to Emerald City, well, nobody sings again. It's just all that interesting underscoring. So for a musical on stage, audiences don't want that. We want at least one more song before the end. That is the difference, the major differences between the 1987 version and anything that had come before. Then we have 2011, Lord Lloyd Webber, Sir Tim, and Jeremy Sams. I don't know if he has any letters before or after his name yet. They created the most filmic version of the stage musical for the West End. The most interesting thing they did was flesh out the Kansas part. It goes for a lot longer than it goes in the movie, and people have songs and more fleshed out characters. Because I think that link between the farmhands and Scarecrow, Tin Man and the Lion is lost on a lot of people because the Kansas bit is so short.
Oh, it's certainly lost on me.
Then when she wakes up and she says, oh, and you were there, and you were there. She's saying, you were the Scarecrow to one of the farmhands.
You were the Tin Man. You were the Lion.
Exactly. And because the MGM version didn't dwell on the black and white Kansas stuff, it has been lost. So I think it's a good idea. They wrote some more songs, and they are, obviously, I cannot sing any of them for you.
Copyright.
Yes, that's right. There is a song, Dorothy gets another song, and it is kind of the same main theme notes of Over the Rainbow, but kind of inverted. So it still sounds like the original composers composed it for this work. It fits very well, and you would imagine that it was written by them and taken out of a drawer somewhere, but it actually is Lloyd Webber. So good on him for not trying to make it Lloyd Webber-esque and actually something that suits the rest of the musical as a whole. Very interestingly, Michael will find this very interesting. Don't know about you guys.
Tell me.
The wizard / Professor Marvel was played by Michael Crawford.
Interesting.
So this is post, this is 2011, so post The Phantom. So we all know he can sing by now.
Oh, of course.
And they added some songs for him, a song as Professor Marvel and then another one as the wizard. So there's a much broader role for that character.
Who would have thought that Michael Crawford in Some Mothers Do Heaven would branch out to be this wonderful singer and wonderful actor in Broadway?
All the people who saw Hello, Dolly, which was before Some Mothers Do Have Him.
Yes, exactly.
When he played Cornelius Heckel, who's 33 yes. and a third.
I'm hoping that could be covered in another show.
I'm sure it's behind one of these doors somewhere. It's got to be.
It has to be.
And also,
we don't know.
Dear listener, we were both in that. So we've got a lot of things to say about that show.
I've got an embarrassing story about Hello, Dolly that I was in that I'm going to tell at a later time.
Indeedy. Another person who got a song because once you find out who it is, you go, well, of course, Hannah Waddingham as the Wicked Witch.
What a perfect role for her.
Yes.
I love Hannah.
Now, a lot of people who are not West End lovers may not realise that that's where she's actually from. Ted Lasso and that weird real estate agent in An Early Midsummer Murder, they're not her main claims to fame.
But she was perfectly cast in that role in Ted Lasso.
She has an amazing voice and an awesome stage presence and would be very, very scary indeed as a Wicked Witch.
What an absolutely wonderful singing voice and acting.
In the film, there was a woman signed on to play the Wicked Witch before Margaret Hamilton. They had told her that she was going to be much more of a sexy kind of witch, not a Wicked Witch, a traditional Wicked Witch. And then they showed her costumes and the script and she went, oh, I'm not interested in that. But now they have somehow managed to tie that all in and they give her a reason. Because everyone doesn't want to just blanket hate the witch. It's much better to know her backstory as to why she is so full of vengeance. And it is there in the movie, but a lot, I think, by giving her an actual song, she gets to show the whole range of her character.
Jane, yes, you've directed shows and musicals in the past.
Mm.
Do you need a sexy witch character, or would you rather have the traditional?
I like that they bridged both ideas. So she's not like a sexy witch. It's not like a Halloween costume sexy witch. It's just that she's not a wizened old crone. That's what we mean. The other main wonderfulness of it being Lloyd Webber and therefore having a gazillion pound budget is that they could recreate the film even more so than the Shakespeare Company one did. They had three revolves.
Well, to do these things, you need money.
Yes, and you can get that if you're Lloyd Webber and his background. There was intricate technical work including the creation of specialised props such as a remote-controlled Toto. And
no.
I've worked with remote-controlled things on stage, and that doesn't always go
there
to plan.
There are dogs that you can train to do this. Why do you need a remote-controlled dog?
They actually didn't stick with that because I heard one of the Dorothys from this production talk about going on stage with your pocket full of sausages. So that's how they would get Toto to always stand by the hem of her skirt. If they are doing a much more faithful recreation of a tornado, then an actual dog might lose its mind. Because we know what dogs are like during fireworks.
Oh, yes.
So that could be why they had the thought to do it with the
sensory thing.
Remote-controlled dog. The complex automated set changes combined with visual projections for the tornado sequence.
That sounded like a mouth.
You want me to break that down?
So yes, please.
There would be the three revolves with different bits of set coming to the front, to the back, actors and stage crew pulling things off, throwing things in the air, and at the above back, on the cyclorama probably, were projections a la the movie of the cyclone. So it was a very full-on spectacle. And that might be the reason that the Royal Shakespeare Company version is still the one that is toured all around the world, because you would not only have to have the millions of dollars to cart all that stuff around and train the local people in its technical stuff, you can only book theatres that have all the same ability as the London Palladium. And so it couldn't come to the Festival Theatre because it would need this and that.
This is the Festival Theatre in Adelaide.
Yes, or even maybe there might be a Festival Theatre in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I don't know. So you could write in and tell us where your Festival Theatre is in your state and or territory.
Email address?
aoas@mail.com.
Getting back to the RSC, so you're saying the RSC's production of The Wizard of Oz is the standard production?
It is. So it's the one that is most closely aligned to the movie, because there are others that are licensable for community groups and theatres, and they are adventures of The Wizard of Oz, so they relate to the book. They don't have the same music. So if you advertised you were doing The Wizard of Oz and you didn't have Over the Rainbow and We're Off to See the Wizard, a lot of people are going to be quite disappointed. So it is the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company version from 1987. That is the one that we have seen most recently in Australia. Now, Michael, you are responsible for the synopsis of the plot for this edition of the show. What has your research revealed?
Well, we visit a farm in rural Kansas to meet Dorothy Gale, her Aunt Em, Uncle Henry, and Toto, her companion dog.
Dorothy Gale. Have you ever stopped to think about the significance of her surname?
Gale. Wizard of Oz.
The tornado.
The tornado.
Because a gale is a huge wind.
So living together can cause problems, as Dorothy feels misunderstood as she sings Nobody Understands Me.
Oh, that's one of the new ones that Lloyd Webber, etc. have put
yes,
in.
Yes, right. Yes. This helps Dorothy find a place to belong. Befriending Hunk, Hickory and Zeke, and wanting to feel free, she sings Over the Rainbow.
So they're the farmhands?
Yes.
Right.
Dorothy's well-being goes out the window when Toto is assumed to bite Miss Gulch, as she takes Toto to be euthanized.
Gosh!
I know, it's horrible. Dorothy flees the farm, meeting Professor Marble, and enchanting Dorothy as he sings The Wonders of the World. Cue the tornado, stage right. Damaging everything in its path. Seeking refuge, Dorothy is knocked out of the farmhouse and transported to Oz, a mythical place. Dorothy lands on the Wicked Witch of the East, freeing the Munchkins from the witch's reign of labour. Happy Munchkins sing Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. And Glinda, the Good Witch of the North, gives Dorothy red ruby slippers to keep her safe with these words: to get home, follow the yellow brick road. To a place called Emerald City, where the almighty Wizard of Oz may grant you a wish. Seeking vengeance, the Wicked Witch claims the ruby slippers are hers, as Dorothy killed her sister. Yellow Brick Road time, as Dorothy encounters Scarecrow, who doesn't have a brain. If I Only Had a Brain is sung as Scarecrow joins Dorothy as Tin Man enters the scene. If I Only Had a Heart. Lion joins too. The quartet then sing We're Off to See the Wizard, facing danger, enchanted poppies and snow falls. At the gates of the Emerald City, all four put their demands to the wizard. A brain for Scarecrow, a heart for Tin Man, courage for Lion, and a path home for Dorothy. This ends Act 1.
Don't forget to stick around while our special guest,
Peter Ayers,
reveals the next show behind the door.
Act 2 starts and our adventurers are still at the gates of Emerald City. Dorothy's plea of heart opens the gates to a world of dazzle and happiness.
What does plea of heart mean?
Well, they're pleading for the gates.
Oh, a heart-rending plea.
Yes. Open the gates!
Right.
Open the gates, please let us in. Dressed in emerald attire, the team are led to the throne room of the wizard, demanding submissive obedience of them all, with a promise and guarantee with what they demand of the wizard. The wizard wants the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West as proof of defeating her. Off they go again, haunted forests, poppy fields of slumber, and visions of fear and danger. They have their mateship, and never giving up when the Wicked Witch and her flying monkeys are let loose, who take Dorothy and Toto for the ruby slippers. Red Choose Blues is sung to celebrate the capture.
Oh, that's the new song that they wrote for Hannah Waddingham.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Hell in a Cell for Dorothy and Toto. The Wicked Witch demands the ruby slippers. Dorothy says, no, 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 no. The witch says, yes, 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 yes. This goes back and forth as the gang dress up as Winkle Guards to rescue Dorothy and Toto. Dorothy is really annoyed now and throws water over her fire towards the witch, and the water dissolves the witch, freeing the Winkies and getting the broomstick as proof for the wizard. This sounds like a video game.
It does, rather.
Returning in triumph to Emerald City, Toto runs towards a curtain. Curious, Toto pulls the curtain open and we see the wizard as a man, a travelling salesman from Kansas. Promises are fulfilled, a diploma as a replacement brain for Scarecrow, a beating in-time heart for Tin Man, and a medal to befit the courage of a lion. What about Dorothy? It's the ruby red slivers that can take Dorothy home to Kansas, with saying five simple words, there's no place like home. Dorothy wakes up, it was all a dream, seeing the ruby red slippers acts as a reminder of her travels with friends who gave her courage, strength, and the power of believing in yourself, and that home is the best place to be.
Ah,
I know, it tugs at your heartstrings.
There's an interesting thing that in the book, it is not all a dream.
Yes, I'll get into that in trivia.
Aha, I can't wait.
You're listening to Another Opening, Another Show, a musical theatre podcast via the Gawler Broadcasting Association's website, which you can search on Google. And you can also listen to Another Opening, Another Show on Spotify and Castbox. Now, Jane, it's time for a brand new segment to Another Opening, Another Show.
Oh, yes.
This one I like to call Trivia.
Trivia?
Trivia.
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 Mm.
Ooh. I will come up with about six or so bits of trivia about each musical we discuss.
Okay.
Number one. The iconic song Over the Rainbow was almost cut from the movie due to the length of the song.
Pish tosh.
In the movie, the snow and the poppy scene was actually asbestos.
Oh my wordy lordy. How many ill people 50 years later did that create?
Can you imagine? The horses in the movie in the Emerald City scenes were covered in jello. The horses kept licking the jello off.
What purpose did the jelly serve?
Well, you know the colour of the horses.
Oh, to colour them.
Green jello.
Oh, well, great idea, but not with lick marks.
Margaret Hamilton's role as the Wicked Witch of the West is ranked by the American Film Institute as the all-time greatest female villain. Her copper-based green makeup was toxic, and as a result of this, she had to drink only liquids during filming.
Oh, dear.
In the book by L. Frank Baum, Dorothy's slippers were silver.
Yes.
And Oz was a more realistic place, not a dream as seen in the movie.
Aha, uh-huh. Yes.
And here's the bit that I love, my favourite bit of trivia.
Mm-hmm.
L. Frank Baum got the name Oz from a filing cabinet drawer labelled O to Z.
Yes, I have heard that. And then I heard somebody debunk that. But I think the debunking got debunked. I'm going to stick with it was from the filing cabinet. That's what I'm going to say.
Yes, I like
want to believe that.
That.
That's where we're going.
Stick with the filing cabinet. You can't debunk a debunker.
Now, I have heard some interesting tidbits about that 1903 version.
Yes, feel free to add trivia of your own for our dear listeners on another opening, another show.
They decided that instead of having a dog called Toto, presumably because it's hard to work with dogs on stage, they created a cow named Imogen. They follow Dorothy around. So presumably in the pantomime style of a two-person inside a cow suit situation.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little cow, Imogen.
And also, on the wavelength of the pantomime tradition, the cowardly lion didn't speak. Because animals in panto never speak, they're just always mute and mime.
Interesting.
Mm. Hello, dear listener. We are joined today by Peter Ayers, host of Stages Podcast, which I've been a listener of for many a day and never miss an episode. Peter, what unique qualifications do you hold to be yakking on with us today?
Well, where do I begin? I believe that our focus today is, of course, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Indeed.
A terrific musical, which I had the great pleasure of being associated with in 2001, I think it was, where I got to be a whole array of characters.
And that would be the Nicky Webster one, if I remember correctly?
Yeah. John Frost and some other producers got together and I imagine capitalised on the success of Nicky doing the opening of the Sydney Olympics. So in 2001, they staged Wizard of Oz so she could play Dorothy.
Aha. I didn't see it. It did come to Adelaide, didn't it?
Yes, it did a national tour. So
We were living in London at the time, so we didn't see it at all in any version here.
Right.
Our first question to all guests is, when did you first come across this show? In regards to The Wizard of Oz, though, it could be, when do you remember not knowing about The Wizard of Oz?
Well, it's a bit like that, isn't it? I think everybody has been blooded on The Wizard at a very young age. Look, I go back to a time before VHS and DVDs and all that sort of thing where you had to sort of tune into the Sunday afternoon movie.
Back in my day.
Would be shown.
Yes.
Back in my day. So it seemed to be an annual event around Christmas time, I guess, where the family
That's what I was thinking.
That would be the annual screening of The Wizard.
It's Oliver used to be New Year's Eve.
Okay.
Because we were always at somebody's house every New Year's Eve and we were allowed to go and watch that instead of listening to adults raving on.
That'll mind the children for a while.
Yes. It's a slightly PG kind of a show, but never mind. And is The Wizard of Oz your favourite show? And if not, what is?
Gee, that's a... No, it's certainly not my favourite show, although it is a beloved show. Ask anybody what their favourite musical is very difficult. I enjoy a whole eclectic range of musicals for various reasons.
Mm.
I could probably give you a top five, but there's certainly no favourite.
It's a bit, say, which is your favourite child?
Just a bit like that, yes, absolutely.
Yes. When you were in this to production... Was there a particular role that you could say was your own? Or were you more of a swing? Did you have a name? Or were you ensemble person number five?
I will tell you exactly. And look, the wonderful Bert Newton was playing The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Pamela Rabe was playing the Wicked Witch.
Rabe.
There was a fabulous cast.
Mm. Oh, we really did miss out by going to England.
We did.
On the other hand, we saw Les Mis for 1750. So when we lived in England.
Now, just to clarify, dear listener, that's £17.50.
That's still a bargain.
It's still a bargain.
Okay.
Still a bargain.
Who were you in this show?
My role in the show, I joined as ensemble, but within that ensemble plot, the ensemble or the chorus, whatever you like to call us, really has no rest at all, because one moment you're playing Munchkins, and then you're diving off to get into your jitterbug costumes. You are the citizens of Oz, in the Merry Old Land of Oz. You are the Winkies, which is the Witch's Army.
Mm-hmm.
But as well as that plot, I also understudied Doug Parkinson as the Cowardly Lion, and Tony Gapin as Uncle Henry, because Bert was doing his daytime TV show at that time.
Of course. Oh, sure.
So there were occasions when he'd miss performances because of that. So Tony, playing Uncle Henry, would step into the wizard's shoes, and I would step up into Uncle Henry's
right.
shoes.
Right. You were in a very young Uncle Henry in that time, in 2001.
I was, yes, there was lots of grey powder.
Who would you like to play in The Wizard?
Well, I think I got to play my favourite character in The Wizard, which is the Cowardly Lion. To me, he is the I know he has a heart, but he is the heart of the show.
Mm.
And extremely funny.
Yes.
And, you know, he's like those three characters. They're all different, but they're different. Everybody embraces their difference.
Yes, it is a quite a modern thinking musical in that respect. You know, they're always raving on these days about let's make sure there are people of difference in the cast so that more people can relate. And by that whole concept of the trio, is there is something you can find in yourself that's represented by the three. And Dora.
Diversity, of course. I mean, the film was 35, isn't it? I think the 1935 of the film. So
39.
It was way ahead of its time.
Mm,
39,
yeah.
Wasn't it? Yeah, it was in the 30s. And of course, you know, those three, you know, the gay community have sort of taken Friends of Dorothy.
Indeed.
As a token sort of name for sort of expressing their difference and minority. Yeah.
Do you have a favourite interaction in the show? Or a favourite relationship?
I think that it's always very powerful when the four of them, Scarecrow, Tin Man, Cowardly Lion and Dorothy, well actually there's five because there's Toto as well, isn't there? When they first confront the wizard and you've got that enormous brimstone and fire and that huge gold face sort of coming down, and they are petrified. But then the curtain parts and we realise it's just this little old man.
Yes. Now, do you have a favourite song from Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, well, you probably can't go past Somewhere Over the Rainbow, can you?
Which, indeed.
Again, sung so beautifully by Judy Garland in that 1939 film, and became a standard with a lot of people.
Mm. Yes, when I'm putting together the Spotify playlist that accompanies the episode, I don't know how to stop myself from just listing every single different version of that song.
For example, the version by Israel Kamakawiowole.
The ukulele is really, really special.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's wonderful.
And quite different from how the composers would ever have thought it could be played. And therefore I've got more time for it than somewhat overindulgent Mr. Patinkin.
But it just shows how adaptable Over the Rainbow can be to different genres, even from the stage to a ukulele player.
Yeah, it's very, very well thought out and beautifully performed, that version.
Great song.
Mm. Now, we know it as the film musical. Do you think it translates well to the stage? Or would you have preferred it to have stayed as film musical set in Aspic forever?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because unlike Wicked, which goes the other way.
Yes.
It started as a stage show and became a film, which with Wicked, I absolutely prefer the stage show. I mean, there's something that you can do in the theatre. And look, of course, there's stuff that you can do in cinema too, which you can't do in the theatre. But the theatrical experience is much more satisfying to me. And I think, you know, while the stage version of The Wizard of Oz certainly satisfies, you can't beat the magic of that original film. I mean, that moment when they go from black and white into colour The Land of Oz is just spectacular.
Yes, yeah. It's a very American show. Do you think it would translate if it were Burke rather than Kansas?
I think so, because it's all about we are humans searching for something which they feel they don't have, but it's always inside of them, of course, and they just have to come to a realization where it is there. So I think it's a very universal studio. When I knew you were going to ask me a similar question, Jane, I remembered in the past, in Australian cinema, there was a film that was made which sort of took the Wizard of Oz story and placed it in Australia. Have you ever heard of a film called Oz? It was a 1976 Australian film. It was a rock and roll road movie written in 1976 in which the plot is a reimagining of the Wizard of Oz film transferred to 70s Australia, but aimed at an older teen and young adult audience. It was terrific. Dorothy is a 16-year-old groupie riding with a rock band, Wally and the Falcons. Suddenly the van is in a road accident and she hits her head. She wakes up in a fantasy world as gritty and realistic as the one she came from and learns she killed a young thug in the process. A gay clothier, Glenn the Good Fairy, gives her a pair of red shoes as a reward to help her see her last concert of the Wizard, an androgynous glam rock singer. She is pursued by the thug's brother, who attempts to kidnap her. She also meets a dumb surfer named Blondie, a heartless mechanic named Greaseball, and a timid biker named Killer. So I thought that was fabulous.
That sounds great.
I love it, Peter. I really do love it.
You're going to be in the YouTube rabbit hole looking for this, aren't you?
I am. Yeah. I absolutely love it. Typically Australian.
1976 Oz.
Excellent.
Yes. Look it up, dear listener. Look it up.
Now, if you were to cast this, The Wizard of Oz, your dream cast, performers living or dead or now aged out of a role, but it doesn't matter, who would be in your ideal cast? And Michael has come up with some of his own thoughts here too.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, I look forward to hearing those. This is quite a challenge, Jane and Michael. I really had to think about this because I think lots of people could fill these roles. But here we go. Who did you have as Dorothy, Michael?
Melissa Gilbert from Little House on the Prairie.
Okay, yep. Mm.
And yours, Peter?
Well, I thought it would be nice to have a connection to the original film, so I'd like to have seen a young Liza Minnelli play Dorothy.
Ooh, oh, yes. Yes, from one generation to another.
Or Lorna, because her voice is almost exactly like her mother's.
Yes, Miss Luft. Yes,
but I don't know about the acting credentials of Miss Luft.
Now, Peter, who have you cast as Toto?
Toto? Well, you'd have to get a particular breed, wouldn't you? It has to be that little sort of terrier, a little dark terrier. Although there are heaps of famous dogs who could fill the role, depends on what you were looking for. I mean, she could borrow Annie Sandy.
Oh, yes. He's a bit large, isn't he? Or is that just because Annie's little?
A bit large. No, he is a bit large to fit into Miss Gulch's basket.
Well, I sort of thought outside the square, and we were talking about mechanical dogs on stage for Toto.
For 2011, in the Lloyd Webber one, they actually did use initially an animatronic animal.
So I thought a dog with intelligence. So I thought of K-9 from Doctor Who.
Oh, brilliant. Yes.
But he'd see right through the professor very quickly.
Yes.
All right. Aunt Em?
Who becomes Glinda, of course, or in the stage. I thought would be called a big presence with a big voice. I'm going for Dame Joan Sutherland.
Oh, wouldn't she be glorious?
Yes.
We need to write a song for her, though.
Yes.
Well, it's absolutely, she should demand a song. Come out, wherever you are.
I've actually thought of the actress who would play Aunt Em, and then later on I've gone for another actress who could play Glinda. So I've gone for Aunt Em as Elizabeth Sladen, who was Sarah Jane in Doctor Who.
You've got a theme going here.
I have. I have. And for Glinda, I thought of Janelle Maloney from The West Wing, who played Donna Moss.
Bradley Whitford's character's assistant.
Yes, exactly.
As Glinda. Yes, I could see that. She might have even played it. We need to research.
Exactly.
Michael, you'd be a terrible producer because you've got two salaries there that you have to pay now.
Let's move to your big three, Scarecrow, Tin Man and the Cowardly Lion.
Well, with the Scarecrow, I thought, who's hot at the moment, who would be good for box office? And Timothy Chalamet.
Oh, yes.
Wiry and tall. Yeah.
My kids love Timothy Chalamet.
They Yes, it would be great. And then a double act for Tin Man and Cowardly Lion. I thought you can't go past Steve Martin as a Tin Man and Martin Short as a Cowardly Lion.
Oh, yes.
Yes, exactly. Well, I thought of Scarecrow as non-singing, non-dancing. I thought of David Tennant.
Okay, yeah. Another Doctor Who.
Another Doctor Who. And Tin Man, I thought...
Doctor Who does the Wizard of Oz.
Why not?
I'm sure there are lots of West End renegades and Doctor Who you could...
And sonic screwdrivers and everything else.
No, don't blend it.
Tin Man, I thought of Ian Armitage from Young Sheldon.
Yes, yes, go for that one.
And Lion, I thought of Dulé Hill from The West Wing.
Do you know, you are sounding like you are from our sister podcast here of the cult TV show group, the Doctor Who and The West Wing. Who have you got for Professor Marvel / The Wizard?
I thought a wonderful actor who's so charming and is known for playing a host of sort of hoodwinkers in the films that he's done, Bob Hope.
I suppose he was a bit too soon in 1939 to cast him.
Yes, he was probably the age of the trio. He's probably a bit young, yeah.
Mm. I thought of Michael Sheen.
The Welsh actor.
Yep, lovely.
Now, your Wicked Witch.
Well, the best witch that I have ever seen, who I think would be wonderful in this role, who probably would have been around for casting in 1939 as well, Agnes Moorehead, who played Endora in Bewitched.
Oh!
Yes!
She was probably young and glamorous at that point, though.
But still, I've gone with Alison Janney.
She was in 9 to 5 on Broadway.
Yes. I thought, what a perfect casting as the Wicked Witch. But there are also various roles, Peter, in The Wizard of Oz, like Munchkin Mare, Tin Polisher, and Crow in Cornfield. Jane, who would you cast as Crow in Cornfield?
I asked him to feed me that, now I've forgotten.
Dear listeners, Jane would cast Jeannie Little in that role.
Just as the crow, just a cameo. Dal!
Did you enjoy that, Peter?
I enjoyed that very much. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Now, dear listener, Mr. Ayers is going to open our advent calendar door number 6. What has it revealed?
Let me open, and this is a very big advent calendar. You're planning to run this podcast for many years, aren't you?
Yes. We will just be here in the bowels of the Civic Centre until 2059.
Okay. Number 6. Is Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Oh, exciting.
First Australian musical.
Of our list.
Mm. Wonderful. Right.
Congratulations.
Yes, and there are lots
of... It's a great show. Great show.
Yeah, I once coached some of the boys in the Adelaide production of the tour. That was fun.
Peter, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on another Open and Another Show.
Thanks a lot.
It's been my pleasure. Michael, you've done very well in your debut performance. And Jane, congratulations for starting this podcast. It's wonderful for listeners to sort of access the myriad of musicals which are out there. So may you long continue.
Thank you. And thank you for being an inspiration.
Yes, Peter, we love you.
A pleasure.
Ciao. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that wraps up another episode. Did you have fun, Michael?
I did. I loved every minute of it, Jane. It was a wonderful debut episode for me to get into, and I can't wait for years and years of episodes to come.
Well, there is a world to discover.
It's a huge world.
And we are really enjoying it because we're not always talking about shows that we know / love. We are finding out what other people love about other musicals too.
We love having you join us on another Open and Another Show. Don't forget to email us at
aoas@mail.com. Also, could you please like and subscribe, as they say in this industry? It helps other people know we're here.
And you can join us as a follower on the podcast as you listen to it on Spotify or Castbox, or you can listen to it at the Gawler Broadcasting Association's website. Search for that on Google.
Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.